Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Kyle Lamb. We're here tonight on a very special podcast, Hoops HD version, an off-season podcast where we're going to talk about what I think is a very important issue. We'll get to that in a moment, but joining me tonight live and not so much in color is David Griggs. David, how are you doing?
Pretty good. Yeah, a little bit different format tonight. We're going to get into what we're going to be talking about, some issues that we just thought we'd come across better in an audio format. During the season, we have a lot of fun. We're talking about games and coaches, and we're having a lot of fun and doing a lot of stuff with the David Griggs puppet character. We just thought for these particular topics, it would be better if it were audio only, which is why we're doing audio only. Anything, I don't know, is that right, Kyle? Or do you just think I'm ugly? Maybe it's just that.
Oh, maybe. I just want your word that you're on your best behavior tonight. That's really all I'm concerned about.
Okay, yeah. Well, my best behavior isn't as good as other people's okay behavior, but I'm on my best tonight.
Oh, yeah, your best behavior only has to be somebody else acting up a whole lot, and then we should be okay.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, the topic that we wanted to talk about tonight is, and unless you're living in a cave, if you're, you know, a college sports fan, you know, as you know, you know, there's a really big, really big set of events that have been happening here the last couple months. You know, just briefly, we're gonna kind of go through this. A couple of Northwestern football players were interested in the possibility of unionizing. And, of course, this is, you know, a huge thing. In order to form a union, it would require being ruled as employees. And, of course, a couple months ago, a few weeks ago, after the National Labor Relations Board, you know, heard the case of these Northwestern football players, they did determine that, in fact, Northwestern football players were being treated as employees. And what this meant was, according to the NLRB, basically, all private colleges and universities that sponsor athletics in the country could unionize if they saw fit. And so the Northwestern football team decided to go ahead and have a vote this past week. A few days ago, they went ahead and voted, and it was by secret ballot. We still don't know the results of that, and we'll get into that later. But they had a vote to decide whether or not they're going to unionize. Now, this is a very, very, very important event in the history of college athletics, because if they do vote yes, you know, currently Northwestern is appealing the NLRB ruling, and if that appeal is rejected, then what this means is if Northwestern votes yes, or if any other school comes along and votes yes, then basically we will have union for college athletics. Now, of course, people are going to ask, why do we need unions? And very, you know, a whole lot of people, in fact, are very vocal that, you know, we don't need unions in college athletics. Well, that's where, you know, David Griggs and I are going to go over some of the issues why, in our opinion, we're not so much advocating for unions, as we'll get into later, but we are advocating for some changes that need to be made in college athletics. And some of these things that haven't been done are why you know, these athletes at Northwestern are considering unionizing. And it should be worth noting, David, I know this is a big point of yours, it's not all about paying players. And I know that this is the subject that gets the headlines. It's the buzzword that everybody likes to talk about. But this really is, David, more than just about the issue of paying players.
Most definitely. And one of the things that's aggravating to me is the statement. It's like, well, you know, we shouldn't need unions. Well, we don't need unions. The correct answer is we should need unions. It's a shame that it's taking this kind of a measurement to get some of these reforms. And what the Northwestern players want, they want a limit on practice time. They actually want the 20-hour rule to be the 20-hour rule, and not the 45 to 50 hours a week that they spend in meetings, voluntary workouts, and things of that nature. They want a limit on the amount of class time football players miss. Typically, for a Saturday game, the rule is you're allowed to get there 48 hours before. So a lot of schools will leave on Thursday, or they'll leave early Friday morning for a game on Saturday night. You're missing all your Friday classes, And that, it makes it more difficult for them to perform as students. Something that you may not know is that for football, I don't know why this happens in football and not other sports, even for home games, they'll check into a hotel Friday. So even if they're playing at home and not going anywhere, they're typically not going to class on Friday. So during the season, that's one day out of the week where essentially they can't even go to class. They want that rule changed. They want essentially a cap on the amount of class they're allowed to miss. They want to be able to major in whatever they want. And that's one of that's another problem is that that I guess a lot of people may not realize is that if football practices from like 2 to 6 every day, they basically are limited to the classes they can take. It's not unusual for a player to have to change their major simply because the classes they need for their desired major meet during football practice. They want an arrangement made to where either practice is moved or something to work out to where they can major in anything the college offers. I know there's some other big ones I'm probably missing. One of the things they are not asking for, this is the group out of Northwestern, and is this the CAPA? Is that what they're calling themselves?
Yes.
The college athlete. Okay. One of the things they are not asking for is a salary. So right now, I know it's going to be about money. I know it's going to be about paid, especially if unions come into it. But what is sparking this? What they are basically asking for initially has nothing to do with a salary. And one of the things that's aggravating to me is the NCAA's response to this. Looking at this list of grievances, I think they had 14 things that they wanted, all of them reasonable, all of them well thought out. They're not responding to any of that. All they have said is that college athletes have no right to unionize.
Well, so
it just bothers me that their actual issues, the actual grievances, have been completely ignored by the people in charge.
Well, and it's a good thing that you brought up too. The fact that they have to change their major, and because one of the things, people were asking, well, how could the NLRB rule that these guys are athletes? There's just a lot of people, just are absolutely turned off by the concept of athletes being called employees. But, the NLRB, after, going through the testimony and all the hearings that lasted a couple weeks, and, there were hours upon hours of testimony from coaches and players and academics, faculty staff and athletic staff, there are four prongs that, according to the NLRB, not all four have to be met, but there are four prongs that determine whether or not, college students are considered, employees within, when they have obligations to the university. And these four prongs are the player students, number one. Obviously, in this case, the answer is yes. We know that Northwestern football players are students. Number two, is the work an integral part of the student's educational experience? Andy Staples of Sports Illustrated actually, wrote a column about this, and he said, one of the things that was working against Northwestern is that, if a player, let's say, has a communication study degree that he's working for, they can study for this without playing football. So while it's debatable as to whether or not, this is an integral part of the educational experience, obviously they don't have to play football to get the degree. So, that one is it's tricky, but, it doesn't look good for Northwestern. The third prong was who oversees the student work. And, David, as you know, as you mentioned, one of the big problems that Northwestern and other schools are having right now is that, it used to be that football or basketball or any sport was scheduled around the athlete's class time, and the athlete, the athlete's major was determined on his or her own accord, and, that was that. You're either eligible or you're not.
This cannot be stressed enough, what you're saying now.
Yes.
This cannot be stressed enough.
Yeah.
Their academic and educational options are absolutely limited.
Yeah, and I want you to to explain why that is, because people are probably wondering, well, why can't Joe quarterback of the football team, why can't he just automatically take whatever major he wants? Explain what happens and why sometimes.
Okay, I'm going to relate to my own experiences. I'm not going to say where I've been, but I am going to. I have spent some time around Division I athletics and major, sort of college football. But essentially, what happens is they're in practice 2 to 6 every day. That's what's logged. There's voluntary meetings that generally start about 1 o'clock. 1 o'clock, 1:30 for positions. There's treatment before and after practice. So again, even though they're only practicing from 2 to 6, essentially the football day starts before 1 and goes until after 7 by the time treatment's done, film sessions are done, voluntary meetings are done. And what ends up happening is that you basically cannot go to class between 1 o'clock and 7 o'clock. So, you know, if you're at a school, and by the time, now, when you're first starting out, freshman, sophomore year, there's things that you can take that are offered in the morning. But if you're a business major, if you're an engineering major, chemistry, biology, a lot of those labs, a lot of those classes are offered in the afternoon. And I have seen this multiple times, and by multiple times, I mean 5 times a year at least, probably more than that, where a kid is specifically told, you have to choose between the major you want and being on this team, and if you choose your major, we're not paying for your scholarship anymore because you're not going to be on the football team anymore. Now, what's aggravating about that is that things could be done. He could arrange to practice and work out at a different time. The team could practice in the morning or later in the evening. There's things that can be done, but they typically aren't. I had a personal experience to where somebody was getting out. The school I was at, there were 5 students that were on the football team that were getting out of class at 12:45, which, again, with voluntary meetings starting at 1, the coach did not like that because they were going to be 10 minutes left of their voluntary meetings, and he basically orchestrated for those classes to be changed. Some of those kids, because they had to change their classes, and again, it was more than one, and it happens more times every year. It ended up delaying their graduation for a year because, like, they could have taken that class and gotten out, but now they have to wait till the following year, and some of them had to change their majors. And this is not, and I want to emphasize this is not unique to where I have been. Talk to anybody that works on the academic side with college athletes, and college football and basketball in particular. Everybody everywhere has stories like that.
Well, and you know, this is something that I've noticed too, and knowing a lot of people that are on the faculty side, you know, it's the faculty despises athletics, and a lot of the problem is because a lot of these same schools, you're getting coaches and academic advisors that are hitting up the faculty and asking for grades to be changed or asking for special privileges, and some of the faculty who maybe don't care for athletics are just being rubbed the wrong way by this. Yes. Now, of course, you know, obviously, at the very extreme end of the spectrum, you have situations like what's going on right now at the University of North Carolina. But, you know, that's not even really the issue as so much as we're just looking at the micro in that, you know, one of the things that the Labor Review Board found was that even at a place like Northwestern, you know, the control really is on the athletic side of things. You know, these players really are... Their scheduling, their majoring, everything, it really is being controlled by the athletic department.
Yes, and again, at North Carolina, I realize that that's in the spotlight now. I want to imply that academic fraud happens everywhere, but what does happen everywhere, even at Northwestern, is essentially they are given a list of classes and told that that's what they'll be taking. And a lot of the times, kids are steered towards classes that they don't want to take, or they're steered towards classes because they're easy. And that was what was happening at North Carolina. Some of those players that were put in those classes didn't really want to take them. They weren't really classes. I mean, they had other interests, but they were put in there because they knew that the likelihood of them doing well was high. So it's more about the standard becomes, rather than getting an education and acquiring skills and moving it on, the standard is getting done what you need to get done with as little work and as time as possible so you can be eligible and play. That is the standard everywhere. especially with football.
And here that leads us to the fourth prong that the NLRB ruled upon: is the student's financial aid dependent on the nature of the services he's asked to perform? Now, this is where I just really rolled over on the floor laughing for a good 10 minutes. The Northwestern, when it laid out its case, had a 50-page request for review for appealing this. This is the gem that really stood out in these 50 pages. Quote, contrary to the regional director's findings, Northwestern scholarship student athletes are not initially sought out, recruited, and ultimately granted scholarships because of their athletic prowess on the football field. So Northwestern basically is saying here in its appeal that, you know, hey, no, we're not recruiting football players because of their talent. And, you know, this is just, to me, when you have such a bald-faced lie like that yeah, everybody can see through, that right there just goes to show what kind of legal case, you know, these players have right now as being treated as employees. Because basically Northwestern has to resort to flat-out lying in order to make its case. It's basically saying, no, you know, talent is not why we're recruiting these players, which is, I mean, nobody believes that.
No one.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous. If that were the case, why are coaches going out and evaluating these football players? Pat Fitzgerald uses up, you know, their staff, I believe, has 200 evaluations a year. Why is it using these evaluations up if that's the case? You know, if you're not recruiting them based on talent, then you don't need to go see these players play. You don't need to request tapes to see them play, because it'd be pointless if you're not evaluating based on talent.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, you know, you mentioned earlier we were talking about, you know, the NCPA, who is, you know, the National College Players Association, who is mounting this. You mentioned the list of goals that they have, and I want to go through here.
Yes.
We're going to go through. We'll go through real quick, and I'll name the 13 goals that they have, and then we'll talk, you know, briefly about each one. The list that they put out a couple months back when this all started, here's a list of 13. Number one, minimize college athletes' brain trauma risks. Number two, raise the scholarship amount. Number three, prevent players from being stuck playing sports-related medical paying. I'm sorry, prevent players from being stuck paying sports-related medical expenses. Third time's a charm.
We'll get to that one.
Yeah,
that's a big one.
Yeah,
that's
definitely a big one.
Yes.
Number four, increase graduation rates. I mean, who's going to argue against that, right? Number five, yeah, Protect educational opportunities for student-athletes in good standing. Number six, prohibit universities from using a permanent injury suffered during athletics as a reason to reduce, eliminate a scholarship. I'm not going to name any names, Nick Saban, but we know of programs where this is allegedly happening too frequently.
Yes.
Number seven, establish and enforce uniform safety guidelines in all sports to help prevent serious injuries and avoidable deaths. Number eight, eliminate restrictions on legitimate employment and players' ability to directly benefit from commercial opportunities. That's another big one that we'll talk about here.
Yeah.
Number nine, prohibit the punishment of college athletes that have not committed a violation. That's another big one. Number ten, guarantee that college athletes are granted an athletic release from the university if they wish to transfer schools. David Griggs, that's another one that you hugely are you
yes,
know, vehement about. And I said 13 and I misspoke. There's actually 11 here. Number 11, allow college athletes of all sports the ability to transfer schools one time without punishment.
All sports. Yeah.
Yes, and that's you know, number 10 and number 11 kind of go hand in hand. But well, David, let's first start at the top of the list. Minimize college athletes' brain trauma risk. This one right now is really just kind of it's in its introductory phase. Basically, yeah, what they're saying is that, you know, they're trying to look for ways to make the sport safer and eliminate the possibility or reduce the possibility of concussion.
Is there a way to do that? I mean, I haven't. This is up and coming. There's things. There's just certain activities that exist in this country that I don't think anybody should do. One is boxing, another is auto racing, and a third, as much as I like watching it, is playing football. It's just kind of funny when you see people that have been boxers or football players later in their life, and they're beaten up, and their quality of life is lower. I mean, have you watched football? You're slamming yourself very hard into very large, strong people. I mean, the nature of the activity, there's going to be an increased concussion rate. Now, having said that, if there's ways that they can come up with to lower it, I'm all for it. But part of me just thinks on this one, the nature of the activity, it's a contact sport. It's just sort of like NASCAR wondering why there's crashes. Well, you have bumper-to-bumper traffic going 200 miles an hour on an oil-slick track. It's just a dangerous activity.
The NCPA, it says that one of the things that it's looking for is a little bit reduced contact during practices. You know, football players obviously have 20 hours of practice time a week. I think they're probably, looking to, reduce some of the amount of that time that's spent on, having full contact.
And during camp when there are no restrictions, I mean, they'll be out there 2-3 times a day for 3 hours at a time. I mean, they might practice 14 hours.
Yeah, that's a pretty big deal. They're looking for independent concussion experts on the sidelines, and they're looking to they're asking for having a portion of the new football playoff revenue to go back into research and development for current and former players. That's also not just for paying expenses, but for researching maybe new helmets that might reduce the risk and just research in general for understanding concussions, how they're achieved, what we can do to reduce the risk, and that sort of thing.
One of the proposals, I forget where this came out of, was now the problem is you couldn't implement this in the practices, which is where a lot of these injuries occur, would be to have basically a concussion official. That it's not your team trainer, but it's an official, like a referee, that decides whether or not a player can re-enter a game.
Yes, and I think that's what they mean when I mentioned the independent concussion expert on the sidelines.
Yeah.
So let's go to number two. Now this is obviously the big one, and when you say they're not asking for money, that's basically true. They're not asking for a salary. What they are asking for though is raising the scholarship amount. And I know people are saying, well, you get your room and board and your tuition paid for. Why don't they need extra money? Well, it's very simple. These guys do have their room and board and their books and their tuition paid for. Problem is, if you're a Joe student, working or going to school full time, you have an opportunity to work, work a job outside of school, and you can, make enough to pay for, sometimes or usually make enough to pay for tuition. Sometimes you're on a loan where you don't have to pay for your tuition at the time anyways, but you still have work where you can pay for a car payment, you can pay for gas money, you can pay for incidentals, these things that come up during the week when you're living on your own. The problem with athletes is that, yes, they're getting their scholarship, they're getting their tuition and their room and board paid for, but if they want to have a car payment or if they, want to pay for gas or extras or incidentals, sometimes guys don't have enough to pay for themselves. Now, let me qualify this as saying there are tricks that some people can benefit from that are doing fine, and that's, let's say if you have two football players that are juniors and living off campus, they're both receiving the average, room and board amounts for their university. And so those people in that situation, they're probably making well above their actual expenses because, they've got roommates, sometimes even three or four roommates.
Yeah.
And so they're able to pay, they're actually getting room and board for four people living in one house.
Yeah, now the way this works, Kyle, that like you're allowed to live on campus or you can move off campus and you can essentially, the athletic department can give them the amount of money it would take to live in the most expensive campus housing available. So what they end up doing is, like you said, and this isn't anything, anybody that's been to college has probably done this, you cram 6, 8, 10 people into a 5-bedroom house and to get the rent down. So there is a surplus of money there. It's just the argument against them not giving a stipend because they don't need it. Okay, maybe they don't need it. But so what?
Some of them don't need it.
But that doesn't mean you don't deserve them.
And that's the thing, David. Is some of them don't need it per se, quote unquote, need it. But yeah. Not everybody is fortunate enough to be able to go live in a house with five other athletes and cram in and everything. Not everybody is in that situation. There are some people living on their own, living off of just one tuition check, or room and board check. And in those situations, there are athletes that legitimately are living paycheck to paycheck, so to speak. They really do need the extra stipend to get by and pay some of these miscellaneous expenses. Now, it may be, it may be that only one out of every five athletes are in that situation, but the problem is there is no recourse currently for those situations. And so,
right. I mean, other than the special need one, but my thing is, why do they have to need it in order to deserve it? I mean, who cares if they don't need it? They still deserve it.
It goes to show, and this is what bothers me about this, is you get people, well, they don't need it. And it's like, okay, have you ever asked for something you don't need? I mean, are you only allowed to ask for it if you need it? I mean,
people that are employed probably get yearly or bi-yearly or evaluations. And if they went in and they sit there and it's like, you're doing a great job, and like, we looked at giving you a pay increase, but then it doesn't look like you need it, so, to me, that's just, why do they have to just demonstrate that they need it in order to have it when they clearly deserve it?
Yeah, and to be fair, just 2 days ago, the NCAA, they have made several announcements of things they're looking to do. One of them right now is that they are looking for the five power conferences that are looking for autonomy, and that's another subject that we'll have to talk about a little later, but among the things that they are looking to do is they are looking to issue a stipend of between $2,000 and $5,000 a year to cover the full cost of attendance. So it does look like we're getting to the point where, even if it's out of fear, it looks like they are going to issue this stipend for full cost of attendance. So this is a point that it looks like, even the threat of unionization, it looks like it's going to achieve that goal of getting the extra stipend.
Yeah, and people don't. People are not in favor of this. I don't understand why. Well, okay, you have, first of all, it's so disproportionate. There seems to be this championed ideal of amateurism that people cling on to for whatever reason, and it's the purity of the game, like they're playing for the love of the game and the love of the school, as if like giving them $5,000 a year will somehow make them love the game and the school less. And at the same time, they don't seem to have an issue with millionaire assistant coaches and multimillionaire head coaches. How is it that this like ideal of amateurism isn't applied to them? It's only applied to the players. I mean, I think that's any argument against giving players this stipend is an absurd argument. I have not heard one well-thought-out argument that made any sense at all.
Well, put it this way. Coaches across the country, Division I as a whole, are actually getting paid 5% more of the total athletic department revenue than all financial aid is going to student-athletes.
Yeah.
Just consider that. So let's move on to the third point then, the third goal here, prevent players from being stuck paying sports-related medical expenses. And I know this is surprising to people, but the NCAA does not require schools to cover sports-related injuries right now. It's actually optional, and although most major schools are doing it, not everybody is. And even the ones that are, sometimes there's a lot of tricky you did this on your own accord, in voluntary practice time, and we won't cover you. And that stuff, believe it or not, does happen. It doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen.
It happens. And there seems to be a priority among the training rooms. I mean, these trainers, they work themselves to death. And I've seen this happen, too, to where it's like, we got to worry about the guys that can still play. Like, if anybody is too injured to play this week or this year, don't waste your time and energy on them.
Yep.
And again, we're only trying. Like, if we can't get a guy onto the field, forget it. Like, I mean, too bad. And, I know that this is a later one, but it's kind of tied into this one, where players lose their scholarships because they're not able to play due to career-ending injuries. That happens as well.
Yeah. We're going to jump here. I'm going to increase graduation rates. This one is kind of a loaded gun, but it's not terribly pertinent to. I mean, I mentioned in the fact that it's something. It is one of their goals, but I don't think it's pertinent to some of the issues that we're seeing right now. I will say real quickly, one of the goals that they're asking for is possibly reducing the number of midweek games that occur. I'm not against that per se, and I think it's consistent with what they're looking to do, but I don't think it's a major issue at this point.
Right. Well, if you're going to play midweek, maybe just changing the approach. And I realize football, it's like traveling around with an army. It really is. I mean, like, it's so regimented and so this and so that. And what ends up happening for your Thursday games is coaches, and this is everywhere, they like to basically have the same buildup. So what they would normally do on Friday, they're now doing on Wednesday. What they would normally do on Thursday, they're now doing on Tuesday. And what ends up happening for this Thursday night game is this regular routine that they're in academically, socially, it gets thrown out the window. You might miss a week's worth of class for, you know, because you are playing on a Thursday night game, even if you're playing at home, because the expectation is that you are preparing for that game. Am I explaining that well?
Yes.
Like, yeah.
Okay. I will say this. The only issue I have with this particular goal is the implication is that, you know, they're suggesting that low graduation rates have to do with missed class time during the midweek, and they're using football and basketball as you know, basically the template for why the graduation rates are low. And let's be honest, I mean, the graduation rates are not low because of missing the occasional class midweek. The graduation rates are low because there are guys leaving early for pros. There are guys that are just, let's be honest, they're just there to play sports. I mean, they don't care about graduating. They use up their eligibility, and then they leave.
And then they leave, and then, you know, once they've used up their eligibility, a lot of the support, the tutoring, and all that was there while they were still playing. Because, again, like, you're allowed to play four seasons within 5 years. Once that fourth season is done, if a player has not graduated, they're sometimes just cast aside. Like, you're not worried about what they do academically anymore because you don't need the eligible anymore.
Yeah, and I think that's, I mean, that is the bigger thing. It's, the graduation rates are not going to improve with less class time missed. It just, the guys that aren't graduating are just not, you know, motivated to graduate. I mean, right or wrong, that's the way it is. And again, it comes back to the fact that the guys that are being recruited are not, you know, this is what people don't, they have a hard time accepting this. Whether they should be grateful that they're getting an education or not, they're not. And they're not there for an education. I know they should be, but they're not. And it's time to face reality. They're not there for an education. They should be, yes. They should be grateful that they're getting an education. But that's not reality. So number five, protect educational opportunities for student-athletes in good standing. Five and six is kind of lumped together here. Protect educational opportunities for athletes in good standing and prohibit universities from using a permanent injury suffered during athletics as a reason to reduce eliminated scholarship. Basically, what points five and six are saying is that, You know, right now scholarships are year to year. So basically, if somebody comes in, does a terrible job, they're just, you know, not playing very well, and the coach wants to push them out of the program, he can. If they get hurt and they can't play anymore, a coach can push them out of the program. Because these scholarships are year to year, you know, a coach could just say, you know, we don't think you should be a part of our program. We think you should go elsewhere. And you know, he can be nice about it.
It's as simple as the, we've decided not to renew your scholarship.
Yeah, and they can do that. I mean, most coaches will try to gently nudge a player out, but a coach doesn't have to gently nudge anybody. They can actually just say, we're not renewing you.
Yeah, and I mean, I have sat in those meetings with kids that played football and had a 3.7. Be told, we're not renewing your scholarship.
Yeah.
This, and again, I just can't stress to you enough. I mean, I realize that a lot of fans aren't submerged in athletics. All this happens. I think there's this perception that these are just a bunch of spoiled kids that are crying about it. No, this happens. This all happens. A 3.7 kid, and I think that's good standing. has been told that they're not bringing him back because they weren't panning out on the ball field the way they thought they were.
Yep. And basically along those points, the NCPA is basically saying students that are in good standing with the university and students that get hurt, all of these students should be guaranteed of being replaced with a non-athletic scholarship by the athletic department in the event that they're pushed out of the program. So basically they're saying, okay, you can push us out if you want to and not count against the limit, but you should still continue to pay for the education for the rest of the time we're there. Number 7, establish and enforce uniform safety guidelines in all sports to help prevent serious injuries. This is kind of, basically this is just kind of an extension of the concussions we were talking about, so we won't spend any more time on that. Number 8, eliminate restrictions on legitimate employment and players' ability to directly benefit from commercial opportunities. David Griggs, this is a big one. Basically what this is saying is that, you know, kids should be able to have access to the free market outside of school. So what this is saying, let's use EA Sports as an example. You know, EA Sports, of course, had the licensing to college football game and now is no longer going to because it was ruled that, you know, the players should have a cut. And so the NCAA just basically cut it off altogether because they didn't want to pay players.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, brilliant, right? Basically what this is saying is, you know, the players should have access to their likeness and their name on the outside of college. That's not to say that the colleges should pay them. It's just if there is licensing opportunities, they should have access to those licensing opportunities, whether it's autograph signings, whether it's getting a percentage of EA Sports, you know, revenue, whatever, they should have access to this.
Yeah, and one, I mean, to me, this is just a common sense one. Like, because you don't want to pay the players money that you're basically not, you're going to pass up that deal with EA Sports and make money yourself simply because you don't have to pay the players. I mean, that just seems like utter nonsense to me. Jersey sales, somebody that I know that works in marketing, sale of NFL jerseys, NBA jerseys, soccer, whatever, apparel, at the professional level greatly outweighs that of the college level. And somebody told me this, and it makes sense. The reason for that is because you can have a name on the jersey. In college, you can't. But if college players could have their names on their jerseys, the sales would skyrocket, and I believe it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, just think about autograph signings alone. Let's say you allowed to have autograph signings that are regulated and where people have to, like, whoever is hosting has to actually register their name with the university or a clearinghouse, which I'll talk about in a minute. But let's just say they added that aspect, all right? And let's say colleges got to keep a percentage of the booking fee on top of the athletes getting a prorated amount. Just that alone would create revenue that is not already there for athletics. It would be a completely untapped market that all of a sudden the athletic departments could benefit from this.
Mm-hmm. And have you been to an autograph day? Like, a lot of spring games you see it, a lot of, like, camps you see it, like kickoffs in August, Midnight Madness you see it. I mean, especially at your major programs, Ohio State, Louisville, Kentucky, people will literally wait in the line for 3 hours to get autographs.
Oh, it'd be huge. And right now they do it for they just do it for charity. They just do it for free. But think about, I mean, all of a sudden, if you have an autograph day where you're charging and both the athletes and the university gets to keep the proceeds, I mean, this is a lot of revenue. First of all, this revenue will help pay for the athletics everywhere. I mean, this will help actually ease the burden from universities having to pitch in money. And I think that, you know, they're looking at this all wrong. And I've said this, you and I have talked about this. I've talked about this with our friend Galen, who unfortunately can't be with us on this discussion. But, one of the things that I've said all along is that, you know, it'd be very easy to set up a national clearinghouse, and the goal of this clearinghouse would be to register all third-party licensing and...
It's already there.
Yes.
I mean, for the one, we're going to get down this bit. Like, if you're a student athlete and you're employed over the summer or just during the year in a part-time job, you have to register that job and get it okayed. So it's already in place.
Yes, it's already in place. So basically, what would happen here is you register the job. You know, you have a national rate for each type. So if you want to do an autograph signing, it's based on a national rate. You can't, you know, it's not completely free market, so you can't negotiate it. It's just based on a national set rate, okay? And you register the job or the licensing or the autograph signing, whatever it is, you register it, and all the proceeds go to the clearinghouse, okay? They keep track of it, and they keep tallies of everybody that has participated in a job or a marketing opportunity. At the end of either your five-year clock or that when you've used up your eligibility and graduated, whatever comes first, basically then all of the money you've earned on the free market or in these, you know, employment opportunities gets paid back to you. And this is something that I've also advocated for, that the NCPA is suggesting. They are even going a step further and saying, if you graduate and the graduation rate is high and you don't get into trouble, there should also be a way to attach a bonus at the end of your eligibility to reward you for being a good student. And so basically, they can use all of these third-party marketing opportunities, and when you're done with your education, not only do you get paid all of that, but if you're a good student, you get rewarded too as a bonus. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of possibilities here, and I really think this is a big one that I really hope eventually they cave on. And right now, this is something the NCAA is really standoffish about, because they're really hitting this amateurism thing hard. I don't see them caving on this eighth point yet, but it is something they really should.
Yeah, I mean, it benefits everybody. There's no downside to it.
Yep, there's really not. Point number nine, prohibit the punishment of college athletes that have not committed a violation. And this is NCPA's words here. Quote, it is an injustice to punish college athletes for actions they did not commit, i.e. suspending a team's postseason eligibility for inappropriate actions of boosters. Such punishments have significant negative impacts on the short college experience of many college athletes. Alternative forms of punishment are available and should be utilized to allow an adequate policing of the rules, unquote. David Griggs, this is a big one. You and I have been all over before. Basically, what this is saying, if Joe Schmo gets paid $500 from a booster, the coach knew about it, the coach gets fired, Joe Schmo loses his eligibility, the program gets put on probation, and all of the other players that had nothing to do with this have to sit out and cannot go to a championship event for that year just because one player and one coach screwed up.
Yeah.
The NCPA is saying, stop punishing the people that didn't do anything. Penn State is a great example. Anybody that goes to Penn State, anybody that signed to play for Penn State these last 2 years, will never go to a bowl game in their career at Penn State, all because some coach that was there 10 years ago did something. Now, it was hideous.
But he went to prison. I mean, why do we? And on top of that, people that had never even met this coach can't go to a bowl game.
Yes, I mean, I think we all agree. Hey, let's make Penn State pay a fine. Let's punish Penn State, put them on probation, but don't punish the players.
Guy that did it to prison, which
exactly, you know, punish the people involved, but don't punish the people that aren't involved. And I think that's the big takeaway here is the NCPA is saying, let's punish the right people. Don't punish the innocent. Right. Number 10, guarantee. David Griggs, I know you're huge on this one. Number 10, we'll do number 10 and 11 together. Number 10, guarantee that college athletes are granted an athletic release from the university if they wish to transfer schools. Number 11, allow college athletes of all sports the ability to transfer schools one time without punishment. David Griggs, explain these two.
Okay, well, essentially, like, there are rules, and I don't want to miss one. It's football, men's and women's basketball, hockey for some reason, and now baseball, where if you transfer from one school to another, you have to complete a year of residency, which means you have to be at the school for one academic year, and ultimately you have to sit out a year. But it's only for the revenue sports. It's not a coincidence that it's only for the revenue sports. The reason they have that for the revenue sports is because they want to control the players who play men's basketball and football more.
Not only just for the revenue sports, but it doesn't even count for divisions 2 and 3. I mean, if you're going
right.
if you're
it
a football
for FCS.
If you're a football player to FCS, you can transfer without penalty. If you're a football player to division 2,
you can go from FCS to FCS without penalty, but you can't go up.
Yeah, you can't go up, but you can go to the same level or down without penalty.
Right. So if this is such a great rule, if we're valuing education, why is it that we don't apply this across the board? No, it's not about anything other than coaches wanting control over the players. That's all it is. How is the game better by making a player sit a year? And what you end up happening, football and men's basketball have extraordinarily high transfer rates when put across the board. And the reason for that is a lot of people think, well, wouldn't the transfer rates be lower if you had to sit out a year? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. That's an incentive not to transfer. Well, the problem is most transfers, I mean, I think we had 450 players transfer last year, roughly. Was it more than that?
In college basketball, yeah.
It was a little over
10% of the 4,000 players.
Yeah, and I would say close to 300 of those transferred because of what we talked about earlier. A coach forced them out of the program. And so, again, you have a situation where not all of them, players do transfer for selfish reasons. I'm not saying that they don't. The vast majority of the reason players transferred is because their scholarships are not renewed. And this is just wrong, all kinds of wrong. It's one thing to say you can't play for us anymore. It's another thing to say you can't play for anybody else until you sit a year. That's just wrong.
And let's take it a step further. Not only can a coach say you can't play for us, not only can a coach say you have to sit a year, but a coach can also basically say you can't go here, 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 or here.
Yes.
And if you do, you have to pay your own way for that year you sit out.
Right. What that is, you have to be relieved. Now, again, not having your scholarship renewed generally means you're going to be released, but they can. Like, they can block you. Like, if a player initiates the transfer, the coach can not only make them sit a year, but they can prevent them from getting scholarship aid. So say
anywhere, and there doesn't have it doesn't have to be just one or two schools. They can say we won't release you anywhere. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, yeah. A coach could literally say, "Well, if you're leaving," and again, this is when a player comes to a coach and says that they want to transfer. They're going to be like, "Well, we're not releasing you," which means you cannot go to any school like at the FBS level and get any sort of aid. You would have to sit a year, and you would have to pay your own way for a year.
And let's be clear, too. This isn't just the coaches. There are some universities that have a ban list of transfers that are dozens of programs long for no reason. I mean, they have their own reasons, but it doesn't even matter who the coach is or who the player is. They won't let you go there. They won't release you to those schools no matter what.
Right. A lot of the times you'll see a lot of the ban lists are teams that are in your conference, teams that are on your schedule, and teams that are in the state. I mean, there's various reasons, and I mean, again, there's some that don't have that have all of that, and then there's some that don't have any of that. But in general, when you're looking at the ban list, that's pretty much what it consists of.
Yes. You know, but here's what amazes me about this subject is this is the hypocrisy. I mean, there's no other word to call it. I hear some of the same people, you know, that talk about, well, athletes shouldn't be paid, and they want to be treated. They think that they should be treated like regular students. But then, if you mention the possibility of not having players have to sit out a year, well, no, we can't allow that. They should have to sit out. Well, why?
Why?
If you want to treat them like a regular student,
sense at all.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. If you want to treat them like a regular student, well, then why can't they transfer without penalty? It's not consistent.
Is there any other extracurricular in any level of college that requires you from going to another school and being part of the chess team, in the theater club, writing for the newspaper? Like, there is no other extracurricular other than football and basketball and hockey and women's basketball that makes you sit out a year. There isn't one.
Yeah, it's really amazing, and it's just I don't get the logic. I don't get the lack of consistency with this. It's I can get behind making athletes sit out a year, but if we're going to do it, let's do it for everybody, not just some. Let's do it for all sports, yeah. All sports, all levels, and let's completely, absolutely do not allow coaches or universities to be able to dictate where somebody can be released. You know, that has to be done away with, period.
Yeah, and again, I mean, if this rule is to, you know, if this is to keep the transfer rates down, why isn't it working? It's not working because the reason players transfer most of the time isn't because they want to leave. It's that they're told they're not allowed to.
The college basketball transfer rates have doubled in the last decade.
Yeah. And I actually think removing this year of residency rule will lower the transfer rate. Getting rid of these restrictions will lower the transfer rate because coaches will be less likely to force a player out if they know that they don't have to sit out a year and if they know that they can go wherever they want. And so, again, the reason most players transfer is because coaches force them out. Well, how do we get coaches to stop forcing them out?
Oh, that's just it. That's exactly it. We need to take away the ability of the coach and the school to be able to dictate where the player goes. It's not right, and that's, you know, it's indentured servancy, and that's something I really think of all these things we've talked about. I think first and foremost that's something that needs to change before anything does.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so, you know, we've got about 10 minutes here. You know, I'd like to talk about this, just the general nature of this whole discussion. You know, we talked about, you know, getting the stipend to cover full cost of scholarship. But it just amazes me. I know you make this point a lot. It's just, what I don't understand is there are a lot of students out there already on academic aid, whether it's loans. Loans are probably a bad example, but whether it's a federal grant or whether it's an academic scholarship, There are a lot of students out there that are already getting some or all of their education paid for, and these same kids are allowed to go, you know, let's say, you know, somebody is an artist, okay? You know, he paints a pretty picture, and he enters the picture while he's an art student. He enters the picture into an art contest or an art show.
And just like a gallery, he submits it to a gallery.
Yeah, he submits it to a gallery, and he's able to then, while he's still a student on scholarship, he's then able to sell his painting.
Yeah.
Why is it that, you know, whether you're an artist, a musician, you know, a broadcasting major running the student radio station,
a paid position.
It's a paid position. And I know for a fact, because I went to school for broadcasting. I know a lot of other people that went to school for broadcasting. All these people can be on academic scholarship or grants and do these same things, but you mentioned the very idea of a football player or a basketball player or a baseball player or softball player or sand volleyball player. You mentioned this idea of them getting a stipend for full cost of attendance, and people go haywire.
And yeah, why is it? Okay, and let's look around the other college extracurricular, since these are regular students just like anybody else. A student in film school could make a movie and sell it commercially. A theater major, someone that's in shows, can be in other shows or be in university productions and get paid for that. I mean, why is that not okay? Or why is that okay, but yet athletes aren't? Well, you mentioned the art example. Someone can write for the school newspaper and be on scholarship. Writing for the school newspaper is a paid position. Working for the radio station is a paid position. Working for the student TV station is a paid position. Business majors can go out and get internships and other work experience and be paid for that. I mean, just across the board, you know, why is it that those people, and a lot of those are on full scholarship or partial scholarship, they can be on scholarship, they can earn money working as a student worker within the campus, but yet an athlete cannot. An RA, a resident assistant, is a paid position, and a lot of them are on scholarship.
Yeah, I mean, we double-checked this, and you know, we had to double and triple-check this number. We looked at the NCCES statistics for the latest year they had, which covered 2007-2008. It was 2012 figures, but it covered 2007-2008 school year. and 51% of all undergraduates in the country were on some sort of federal or non-federal grant. That includes scholarships and Title IV grants. And that doesn't include, by the way, those that are on student loans. This just includes grants or other kinds of aid. For the same year, the average person, you know, nationally, all undergraduates, over 21 million, the average person was receiving close to $7,000 a year. Now, a little over $7,000 a year. Now, we should qualify this by saying, yes, this does include all those athletes out there that are on scholarship. But the point is,
it also includes people that are nowhere near a scholarship.
Yes, that's right. but the point is that one out of every two undergraduate is receiving some kind of financial assistance or some kind of financial assistance that does not need to be paid back.
Yeah.
So the point is, there are a lot of people out there. I mean, whether it's participating in the federal work study program where you get paid you get paid to work a job while you're in college to pay for your tuition. You know, whether it's federal work study program or being on a grant or an academic scholarship, there are a lot of students out there that are getting some of their education or all of their education paid for, and yet they're allowed to go out and work jobs
and make money off the fact that there is, like, I mean, if you're if you're an English major and you write a book and you're able, or a short story, and you're able to sell it to a magazine, I mean, you're not going to lose your scholarship and be thrown out of school. But if a football player signs autographs and gets the money for that, they are.
They're called a professional at that point. It's like they're no longer an amateur. So I mean, if that's the case, you know, if you do sell your painting at a gallery, does that make you a professional, or are you no longer an amateur? I mean, it's not consistent. If we're truly going to be intellectually honest about this, we're going to be consistent with what constitutes amateurism and what constitutes the educational mission. Then we have to treat athletes as if they are, you know, having access to the same things that a regular student has access to.
Right.
And people, want to say, and the thing is, people want to say, well, you know, you're getting a free ride, blah, blah, blah. Not everybody else at school gets this. Okay, that's fine. But the people that do get this at the rest of the school, they can still go out and do these other things that athletes can't.
Right. And, I mean, again, they're getting a free, I just don't understand. Well, the two things, like, one of the things that kills me is that I would have loved to have gotten a free, well, yeah, I would have loved to have done a lot of things, too, but you weren't able to do it. I wasn't able to do that. Like, we mentioned him earlier. I went back and listened to a podcast we did about a year ago about Johnny Manziel, and this whole idea of, like, well, they're already getting paid. They have this education. I mean, when I went to school, I worked my way through, and then, well, okay, you just weren't important. Like, you just didn't have the skills that were deemed essential or an asset to the university. You weren't a great artist. You weren't a great actor. You weren't a great writer. You weren't an athlete. I wasn't either. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, those of us that aren't important, we have to kind of create our own opportunity for ourselves by paying for it. Like, when I was in grad school, I worked in student affairs. I had an assistantship. Not exactly a revenue-generating industry. I had my food, my room, my cable, all that paid for, my tuition as a grad student, and I got a $4,500 stipend a year. That's way more than any athlete has ever legally gotten, and I didn't generate anything. So if we're going to, just getting to another point, who was it? Was it Miles Brand or was it the Northwestern president that made the comment, we deem our student athletes to be students, not employees? Okay, okay, if that's the case, what do you deem your student workers be? Are they students and employees? What about your graduate students that have assistantships? They're considered employees and students. What about, like, your RAs? They're considered employees and students. Student workers, they're employees and students. I mean, what about, like, the doctoral students that teach undergrad classes? They're considered employees. So what's this crap about? To imply that you can't be a student and employee is just completely false.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, David, last thought here. We are looking at this Northwestern situation now, and we're kind of in a waiting pattern. It could be months before we know the result of the vote. And the important takeaway here is that regardless of what happens with this vote, even if they vote no, that they're not going to unionize – Because as long as the NLRB as long as the Northwestern appeal to the ruling is shot down, even if they vote now, the important thing here to remember is that any private athletic department, anybody in a private athletic department, as of the ruling stands now, could come along and unionize because of this ruling. So even if Northwestern decides to vote no, this issue is long from being decided.
Right. And, you know, another thought on this, I know we're getting into the final thoughts, and this is one of my last ones. I don't like the idea of resorting to unions to work out these issues. But what's absolutely infuriating, the list of that we went through, CAA hasn't addressed any of it. Like, you don't want a union, then meet these demands. Like, look at these and come to some sort of, make these reforms, and then they won't feel the need to resort to a union.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Why haven't you addressed these, and why haven't you promised to make reforms? Why are you just sitting there with your thumb up your ass saying, well, they're not really, you know, employees, they can't unionize? Well, the MLRB disagrees.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. The NCAA has basically just, instead of actually addressing the issues that wanted to be addressed, they just dug their feet in the sand and say, no, you're not employees. And that was really never the issue. These players or anybody else was never looking to be called employees. They just wanted some of these things to be addressed. And that's really, unfortunately, it took the NLRB ruling them as employees before the NCAA is finally starting to look and say, well, we need to make changes. Well, we've been saying you need to make changes for years and years and years. Why is it they have to be called employees before you look at making the changes?
Yeah, and I mean, okay, a union shouldn't be necessary, but if that's the only way to get you to change, then maybe it is necessary.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Look, I think you hit the nail on the head. This, as my final thought, I think you said it best. I don't think we're not looking to go out and for universities to pay players a huge salary that is negotiated. We're not looking for unionization. I don't even think we'll go so far to say that the players have a raw deal necessarily, but there are things that they're just not being treated intellectually fair. They're not getting. I don't think that for what the expectations they have on them, I don't think they're getting quite what they're expected to live up to. And I think that all we're looking for is just a few things that need to be addressed, and if those things happen, I think we'll all say, yeah, they've got it pretty good.
Yeah.
So, well, David, this has been a great discussion. We're going to keep an eye on this, and probably in a few months after we hear more about this case, whether it's the appeal or the vote or both, we'll probably tackle this some more, and we'll maybe have our friend Chad Sherwood on and get his thoughts as an attorney. Granted, he doesn't focus on labor law, but as an attorney, I know he has some differing opinions on this, and we'd love to maybe have a debate with him about the subject. Anyways, it's been great, and I can't emphasize this enough, David, stay out of trouble.
Okay, I'll do my best.
Okay, well, that's good. I don't know if your best is good enough, but that's all I can ask for. So, well, folks, for David Griggs, I'm Kyle Lamb. Thank you for joining us on tonight's special Hoops HD podcast. We will see you next time.